Blog Talk Radio.
Broadcasting from Atlanta, Georgia, this is The Bright Side with Technisha.
A daily broadcast on real life issues that will keep you motivated.
And now, here's your host, Technisha.
Good morning, my fellow listeners out there today. Yes, I'm starting my show a little early, but hey, you never know how it might go daily on my show. So either I start in the morning, I might start at night, never know. But online with me today, I have Mr. Elliot Katz, who is a professional speech writer in Toronto and the author of 7 nonfiction books, and he has done many radio and television interviews. The audience find him informative and lively. He teaches the principle in his new book that he has out, Being the Strong Man a Woman Wants, Timeless Wisdom on Being a Man. He teaches this to men and women, and he speaks at seminars and conferences. Elliot, how are you doing this morning?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
I'm doing wonderful. How's the weather in Canada?
Snowy, and I like snow.
Yeah. Well, we had our winter storm about like 3 weeks ago. It hindered us a little bit. As they say, the Southerners, we don't know too much about the snow. We don't know how to drive in it. But luckily, I was able to make it through. I had to call off the next day off work because I was like, I don't want to get stuck again. And my boss, he was joking with me. He said, oh, you Southerners, you don't know nothing about the snow. I'm from the North. We know how to get through. I'm like, okay. I bet half of your Northerners probably stuck in that snow. But I'm glad for you to be on my show. I found your book very interesting on being the strong man a woman wants. Can you explain a little bit more why you wrote this book?
Well, this book, it's like a lot of books where people write where they've gone through a journey and have had an experience of learning and they want to share it with others. Excuse me. I was married for 10 years, and then I got divorced. And like a lot of people at first, I blame the other person. You know, it's a common thing to do. And then I came to the point of thinking, well, what do I have to learn from this? I don't want to go through this again. And
yeah.
That really set me off on a journey of learning, like, what does it mean to be a man in a relationship, in a marriage? And, I started talking to other men and listening to what they said, and it seems a lot of men are confused today. You know, we're trying so hard to please women. We're being sensitive. We're, you know, letting women, you know, make decisions because we don't want to be controlling. And it doesn't seem to be working. And then I started reading books. I read lots of books about marriage, and they really didn't say anything to me about what it means to be a husband in a marriage. And then I started going to the, you know, the timeless wisdom, the writings of men from across the ages where men gave the advice that fathers used to give to younger men about being a man in a relationship with a woman. And I was really blown away because it coincided with what I heard women complain is lacking in men today, that they don't show leadership, they don't make decisions, and they don't take responsibility. There seems to me this giant gap between all the things men have been told that they should be and are trying so hard to be and it's not working, and what women really want in a man. And the interesting thing about this book was the reaction to the book. Women have been the strongest supporters of the book. They're the ones saying, yeah, how do I get my husband to read this? And men, when I tell men these ideas, they disagree with, oh, no, that's not what women want. But fortunately, when they ask a woman, she'll say, yeah, that is what we want. We want a real man. We want someone who will take charge.
Yeah, we want somebody to be strong.
Exactly.
We want to start making all the opinions because that's how I feel sometimes in my marriage. I make all the decisions. I'm like, okay, you can jump in anytime you feel like it and say anything, but we don't want you to be, because it is a difference between being a leader or control, but we don't want you to be controlling. I don't want to get beat up. I don't want that type of abuse. I just want you to be a man every now and then. Put your input in. Let me know, hey,
exactly.
We're going to this restaurant. We're not going to this. Give a little feedback. But,
exactly. What you're saying is exactly what I've heard so many women say. That they don't want someone who's controlling. They don't want a tyrant. They don't want someone who's going to tell them everything to do. But they don't want someone who leaves every decision to them, because really, you know, there's a big difference. When a man leaves every decision to a woman, he's really shirking his responsibility about being the man in the family. Like, what do you, like, women say, what do I need him for? He's like, he's just oblivious to everything that's going on in the family. And he thinks he's showing me he's this nice, non-controlling, sensitive guy. And there's a big difference between being controlling and showing leadership. And I have a whole chapter in the book on that. And, you know, someone who's controlling is insecure. They really want things their own way. They're not really thinking about anybody else but themselves. But a leader is thinking about the greater good of his family. He's doing what's best for his whole family, even though it may not be what's best for him, and it often isn't. He's thinking what for the greater good. He's thinking, what is the best for my family? And he has self-confidence, and he's taking responsibility for his decisions that he makes.
Well, why do you feel women actually want a strong man? Because some women, they don't really, I don't think most women really are secure. Some of them just want a man for good looks sometimes. Don't matter. Some like to be controlling in the relationship.
You know, that's a very good question. And, you know, often you'll see, well, if a woman wants a man who's strong, why doesn't she let him lead? Like, why does she try to control him? And I think some women, they want to control men, and they think that's really good because she's getting him to do what she wants. But ultimately, she hates him for it because she doesn't, you know, she wants a real man. She realizes she doesn't have a man. She has, like, a servant. She doesn't really have a man. She doesn't want that. And then ask me, well, why does she always make it difficult? Like, if I try to lead, she criticizes me, she undermines me. And I think, you know, I tell them, well, I tell them two things. One, well, listen to what she's saying. Maybe she's pointing out something that you want, you know, a fault in what you want to do. You want to do something, but you didn't look at a certain aspect, and which would not be for the benefit of your family. Or she could be testing you to see if you really mean it. She's testing you because she really wants to see if you're strong. And she wants to see if you're going to stand up to her. And that often happens, you know, in dating, you know, like people say, you know, a man will say, okay, let's go here. And the woman will say, no, let's go over there. And it's almost like a test. Well, is he going to just give in to me, or is he's going to stand up and say, well, no, I thought this would be a better place and take the lead. And the man will think, oh, he just gives in. I'm giving in, so I'm showing I'm such a nice guy. But the woman is like, oh, he's too weak. He's not going to stand up. If he can't stand up for himself, he can't stand up for me. And that's what she wants. She wants a man who can stand up for her.
And not a mama's boy.
Definitely
want a mama's boy. That's so irritating. Well, when I was in high school, I did have a guy like that, and I thought our future was going to be amazing, but I was like, okay, he buys me this, he's spoiling me. He's already spoiling me, and we're not even out of high school. And then when we got out of high school, he was still doing the same thing, but at the same time, I have to be bothered with your mother, and that was the problem for me. I was like, you know what? I really need a man. I don't need a boy. You're still a boy. You're still depending on mommy to give you your advice, which is good, but at the same time, are you really going to defend for me? So, Ellie, whatever happened to our man really being sensitive, talking about their feelings and developing their feminine side?
Well, you know, a lot of men today, I mean, it's a very good question. And one of the things that's interesting is, you know, I wrote this book for myself and my friends. And, you know, it's been published around the world. It's been translated in 24 languages. And,
mm-hmm.
and it's almost like this whole generation around the world of men weren't taught how to be men. And you look at the situation. A lot of boys today, they grew up in families where, you know, there was divorce. There wasn't the father. If there was a father, he worked long hours. Then they go to school. Most of the teachers are women. They watch television. The men on television are portrayed as buffoons and incompetent, and they need women to rescue them. Where was a young man today to learn, well, what it means to be a man? He doesn't have that strong male role model to teach him, you know, someone that he can copy and say, oh, yeah, this is how a man acts.
Yeah, because usually if men express the sensitive side, then it's because men are, to me, you're held to the standard of masculinity because it's not often includes showing your feelings. So being a highly sensitive person involves struggling to cope with feeling overwhelmed by sensory and emotional information, and that makes a woman wonder, like, okay, he's too sensitive, he's crying. But I think you could be both. You could be sensitive and you could still be strong. We still want you to be there for us when we maybe have a family issue. Because when I'm crying, I like my husband to comfort me. Not, oh, go on about your business. But sometimes he'll uplift me. He'll tell me, look, don't worry about that. Don't cry. He'll bring out the strong side. But sometimes he'll cry too. And not trying to put his business out there because I do love you, honey. But he will cry if he feels like if I'm not showing affection, if I'm not feeling like I love him, he'll be like, I don't feel like you're in this relationship at times. And I have to tell him, yes, I am. So I think our roles sometimes reverse. I'm the one who's being dominant. And I'll be like, oh, I'm still a woman, but I don't want to be manly.
Right. You know, that's a good point. You raise a lot of good points. So, you know, the word sensitive is a real, a tricky word, because what does sensitive mean? If you're saying a man should be sensitive in the sense that he should be sensitive about other people's feelings and not do things that hurt his wife's feelings or other people's feelings, well, of course, a person should be sensitive in that way. But too often it's been translated to mean, oh, he should act like a woman, he should cry, he should, you know, talk about his feelings all the time. And, like, yeah. You know, that's just a big turnoff. And I remember I was once asked, on a radio interview, like, is it all right for men to cry? And I said, you know, he actually even said, it's a sign of strength when a man cries, isn't it? I said, well, you know, it's a matter of context. If, you know, if your parent passes away, you know, something serious, a tragic event happens, yeah, you're only human. So if you cry, you know, you're not a rock. But if you're crying every day because, you know, somebody at work didn't speak to you nicely or something, you know, like, a woman is completely turned off. She wants a man who's strong, that you can lean on, that when there's a difficult situation, he's going to be strong. And if you need to cry, like, you know, okay, cry in private. You know, go in a room by yourself and let it out, and then go out and be strong. Because really, that's what your wife is looking for. She wants you to be that rock that she could depend on.
Mm-hmm. You don't always have to be strong. But as we were saying, I think some men just like to bury their feelings. Because it's social pressure, and it's a way of dealing with the feelings they themselves struggle to understand sometimes. But, Elliot, what are the traits of a strong man?
Well, the most important traits is showing leadership. And people say, what does it mean to show leadership? What people say to me, we've been married for 10 years. She's been making all the decisions. How can I show leadership? Whenever I suggest something, she just ignores me, and that's what happens, right? If you leave every decision to your wife, then all of a sudden something, and this is what happens, right? Something important comes up and you say, well, you know, I've given into everything she wants. This is something that's important to me. You know, I'm sure she'll go along with me. And then you say what you want and then you just get ignored. And then that's, you know, that a passive aggressive reaction, like you just explode. So what do you do if you've been letting your wife run the show for 5 years, 10 years? Look for problems that need to be dealt with your family, with your kids, with your home, anything that within your family, and step forward and say, okay, here's a situation that needs to be dealt with. I'll find a solution and implement it. That's showing leadership. And just keep doing that. At first, you might be startled and sort of like not used to this, you know, but just keep doing it. Just look, keep looking for problems. You know, your kid needs help with his homework. Your kid's not doing well in school. Set up a meeting with the teacher. Take the lead. Don't leave everything to your wife. Keep doing that. You will become her hero because that's what she wants. She doesn't want someone who's just like oblivious, who just thinks, well, I'll bring home the money and then, you know, just sit and wait for his wife to tell him what to do. And,
exactly.
Yeah, exactly. But men think, oh, well, I'm being so nice. I'm being so non-controlling. You know, men will tell me, oh, the woman's supposed to run the home. So I just do whatever she tells me, but...
Exactly. You put pressure on that woman. That's what you're doing, especially if you have children, because she already had to bear the children, probably had to wake up every 2 hours as I did. That's enough already, maintain the household. And if you're working, that's double. So, no, we don't want you to be nice. No, please.
Exactly.
Input.
But you know what? You tell this to men, and men think, no, I'm being the best husband. Like, whatever she wants me to do, I do. I just wait, you know. Well, no, that's not what she wants. She wants a man. Like, she could hire a nanny to do anything she wants. She wants a man who shows leadership. You know, it wasn't that long ago you used to talk about the men being the head of the household. It's like, yeah, it's about leadership. It's like not just being, you know, one of the workers. Like, she wants someone who's taking the lead and like I said, not on everything, but really, that's what people say. Am I saying that men should make every decision? Well, I'm talking about men who make no decisions. That's the frustration that women have with their husbands who think they're being so nice. So next thing is make decisions. You know, I've talked to so many single women, and they'll tell me, they go on a date with a guy, they're just going out for a cup of coffee, and he can't even decide where to go for a cup of coffee. He wants her to decide, and then when they get to a place, he can't even choose a table to sit on. I've seen this, you know, like, well, where do you want to sit? Like, you know, you can't look around and say, well, of all the tables that are available here, I think that would be the nice one to sit at. Like, show some leadership. And I've had women say, you know, if a man does that, that's a big strike against him. It shows you can't even make simple decisions like this. How are you going to deal with serious situations that arise in a family?
Because we don't want
decisions.
We don't like a weak man. We want assertiveness. We don't want to always be assertive. And I think that's what most men think. Oh, she want to be powerful. No, we want to be held. What's the movie? Think Like a Man, Act Like a Woman that they made, and the man was, she was giving him all the points, you know, we're just going to have to be separated. She was a businesswoman, CEO of her company, and she was telling him, we're just going to be separated, and he said, you know what, you sound just like a guy. And she actually had to come out of her comfort zone. Okay, I know I'm a strong woman, but I need a man, and that's what she admitted to him at the end. I need you. I can be strong all day, but I still need that man. That's what had to break down for her. And that's what I think men fail to realize. We might be strong. Yes, we might be a businesswoman, but by the end of the day, we still have our feelings. We're still a woman. Hey, we want our feet massaged. We want to be loved and tender. And men sometimes don't realize that. They don't pick up on the clues. Sometimes they be so clueless, Elliot. But
you're exactly right. I've had women say the exact same thing to me. They say, I may be a boss at work, but when I'm with a man, I want to feel like a woman. I want him to take charge. And they, you know, that's what they think. They think, does a strong woman want a weak man? No, she wants somebody who's her equal. She wants somebody who's equally strong or stronger than her because she wants to feel protected by a man. So, you know, today a lot of women are very strong. They're successful in business and professions. They want a man who's their match, who's going to be strong, who's going to take charge. I've heard it so many times from women. It's exactly what you said. Exactly.
Yeah.
And the third thing is take. Sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
The third thing is take responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so many men, something goes wrong in the marriage, or their wives will pressure them to do something, you know, that they think is wrong, and they give in to the pressure, and then it goes wrong just like they thought it would, and then they blame their wives, or they can't control their wives. Their wives are spending too much, and they go bankrupt, and my wife spent us broke, and they can't understand why nobody has any sympathy for them. They go around and say, oh, look, I'm a victim of my wife. Look what she did to me, and nobody's any sympathy for them. Because we have a natural inclination to expect that a man will take responsibility for what's going on in his home. If you let your wife spend you broke, well, why did you let it go on? Like, you have children. You have a responsibility to not let this go on and to make sure it doesn't start. And if it's going on, to put an end to it. And so take responsibility. Don't blame your wife. Don't blame anybody. You are responsible for what goes on in your home. Don't let things that are going to be negative things go on and think you're going to blame other people. Take responsibility and say, or if you made a bad decision, take responsibility. Don't look for excuses. I made a bad decision. I will fix it. I will take the action to fix the situation. You do that, you know, that's what women really want. They don't want a guy who's a victim, who's blaming other people. Big turnoff.
Exactly. Don't blame nobody but yourself. You're right, and I love that part. Yes. Who was really the inspiration behind your book? Because I know I read mostly through the book, and you talked about your grandpa.
Right. Right. Well, you know, it's I guess in the book is in the form of a story of a grandfather teaching his grandson these timeless insights about being a man. And it really was to symbolize that, you know, this young man who's having problems in his own marriage, he didn't learn it from his father. So it's almost like these teachings missed a generation. So this is almost like a conversation that, like, I envisioned that I wish I had had with my grandfather to teach me these things. I had to learn them on my own, but I said this is like my vision of, you know, like really what a young man needs, that he needs a father or another older male role model to teach him what it means to be a man. And you know what? It's not just young men who need it. Young women need it as well. You see that very often, women who say they grew up in divorced families, they didn't have a father, and they're looking for a male role model. They're looking for an uncle or someone who could show them what it means to be a man, how a man should treat a woman. You know, the positive things, because, you know, they often say a woman will marry a man like her father, and, you know, it can be positive or negative. It could be, you know, he's a bum, he's this, he's just like my dad, or I married a good person like my father. I looked for the good traits I saw in my father in the man that I chose. And so if a girl doesn't have a father, she looks for another man to learn what are the good traits of a man that I should be looking for in a partner.
Yeah. And sometimes that could be a rocky road, because if you're looking for someone of that daddy figure, he could be end up being abusive or something like of that sort. And the same thing, our son looks at his mother so he can know how to treat a woman. So the children, they feed off of us. That's why I try to I try to be a good role model for my children. I don't want the president to be their role model. I don't want a rap artist to be their role model. I want to be your role model. I am your role model. So that's how I tend to see it. But you are right, Elliot. The ones who don't have that privilege, they are looking for that. And, it don't always go that way, because everybody out here don't have good intentions.
No, I know. I know, especially for young women. You know, they get involved with young men, teenage boys, you know, and they think this is love, and the boys don't really know what love is at this stage in their lives. They got something else on their minds.
They be so clueless. I look at this generation now, and I'm like, oh, you all are in for a doom awakening, because they don't have the respect. When we grew up, we had that respect. A guy treated you right. He knew to open the door for you. Now, like you said, these guys, their mind be on one thing. Okay, I'm going to hit it, and then I'm going to leave. You rarely find a good one who has morals, and that's the ones you got to hold on to.
Exactly. It's
So Ella, what is your main goal with this book? What do you want people to get from it? Because everybody don't like to take the same message.
Well, I'm trying to change the world one man at a time. Change mankind one man at a time. I think it's really, these are things, this is really like the timeless insights that, you know, really for generations, fathers or other older men taught younger men about being a man, and it's really been lost in this generation. And I think the loss of these like knowing how to be a man is just underlying so many social problems. Like there's so much divorce, so many kids growing up. You know, divorce, it's not just husband and father, you know, husband and wife coming apart. It's children losing a father. It's so many kids growing up without fathers. It's tragic. And so many kids growing up without male role models, and really without a clue how to be a man. And you know, I'm old enough to remember there was a time when anything masculine, anything manly was considered, oh, that's aggressive, that's, you know, violent. No, yes, some men are violent. That's a horrible thing. But that's not what it means to be a real man. A real man, you know, has self-control. He has integrity. He's a leader. He has, you know, he has strength in his convictions. He wants to lead his family to moral life, to proper life. You know, these are things that, you know, men haven't been taught these days. Like so many, you know, fathers, they say, you see that, oh, they want to be involved. It's almost like they become like a male mother. Like, oh, yeah, they're busy changing diapers, and it's great. I have two daughters. I know it's a lot of work to raise children. But in the same way, you know, it's what about being a man? Like, what does a man give to children that a woman can? He shows them what it means to be a man. And but so many men, like, they just don't realize that they have a special role, and because they haven't been taught, and that's really the goal of the book. It's the timeless wisdom that I found from all these writings that I read. I said, yeah, this makes sense, you know. This makes sense, and really sharing it with other men, and it's been an amazing journey. Just some of the feedback I've gotten, like one fellow wrote, he says, you know, I've been married all these years. My wife says to me, she wants me to be a man. And I really didn't understand what she meant until I read this book, and now I understand. You know, I got one woman wrote to me just recently. She says, you know, I bought this book for my fiancé as a joke. I guess she didn't realize what the book was. She just thought the title was like. So then, she said, then I read it, and there's so much truth in it that, I begged my fiancé to read it, and I think every man should read it. It's like, really? It's just those truths about being a man that have been lost on so many men today. And that's really the goal. It's to get, you know, to share what I learned with other men and have men act like men. And amazing thing is, women keep telling, yeah, this is what we want. How do I get my husband to read this? I had one woman said to me, you know, it's a short book. It'll take you about an hour and a half at most to read. Because I told my husband, read the book, and after you're finished, come to the bedroom. I'm waiting for you in my negligee. See? Just push them. How do we get them to read them? How do we get them to start acting this way?
Mm-hmm. Unless they want to do the scene and think like a man, where they want the revenge. Because in that movie, the women was reading a book on how to defend themselves against men. Like, you wait 90 days before having sex with a guy. If he don't show response, you have your mama boys. Then you have the guys who don't want to be responsible. They want to keep lounging around. Know that you're smart, but you just don't want to work. So when the guys figure out that the women were reading this book, then they want to use it against them. Okay, I'm going to say this. I'm going to say these certain words to get you to have sex with me. And then it backfired on them. And it made all of them think after they figured out, okay, this was not the plan. Then they realize, okay, I do need to go get this job. Seriously, I do need to know how to love this woman. So I feel like your book is sort of like that, like, okay, this is the book that, yeah, you're right, women and men need to read, and men need to step up to the plate, but not use it against us, but really do these actual things for us. This is what we're looking for, and Elliot, he is putting it on the table for you today. So I hope that people take heed to this and actually go get this book, because it's awesome. It really is.
Ellen, thank you.
You're welcome. Ellen, how do women respond to the ideas in this book?
No, it's been amazing. You know, it's it's interesting, because at first I was marketing the book to men, and I really didn't get the kind of response I wanted. And,
okay.
And then when I was at this conference, the book was in the book sale there, and I just saw all these women grabbing the book. Like, it sold out in an hour. And all the women were grabbing, oh, yeah, I need to buy this for my husband. But the men would pick up the book and men don't seem to realize that what they don't know. And that's that sort of thing. It's like, it really takes women to tell them that this is what women want. So women have been so positive towards it. I kind of thought, I would tell men, read the book, don't show it to your wives, just do it. But no, it's the women are buying it and saying, yes, read it. I want you to read. This is what I want. I want a strong man. I want a real man. You know, I was on this radio show once in Boston, and the host was saying, he read it. He was sort of making fun of what I was saying. And then it was a man, right? He says, well, I disagree with you. So let's only have women call in and see if they agree with you or they agree with me, and we'll keep score. So we had five women call in, and they all said, yeah, I'm so fed up with my husband. Because he doesn't make any decisions, he doesn't show any leadership, and they all said that, and like the host couldn't get over. Said, yeah, this is an issue. This is a big issue that's leading. That's really, like I said, it's underlying a lot of problems in relationships. Because woman really wants a real man, and she's so frustrated and fed up when she doesn't have someone. She feels like there's just this man in the house, but he's not really acting like a man, and that's. It's frustrating to her.
It is. I tell you, some of them have so much to learn, and I see that you got great reviews on this. Some people say that you just provide the information about an important topic in an easy-to-read, informal, and interesting manner. The book was excellent, and they look forward to reading it more than once. So a lot of great feedback off Amazon and everything. And I like that, too. If you don't lead, you can't dance. So
right, that's the first chapter. That's the title of the first chapter, and it's about, there's a scene, the book starts with Michael, the main character. He's at his grandparents' 50th wedding anniversary, and that's where he's asking his grandfather, like, you know, share with me, because my marriage isn't going to last another year. So then they arrange that they're going to talk, and then he dances with his grandmother. And, you know, there's this psychologist has this theory about the couples dance. You know, one person steps forward, the other person steps back. And Michael says to his grandmother, you know, I've heard the saying about the couples dance. Is that true? He says. And she said, well, it is true, but in a different way. If you don't lead, I can't dance. So it's like it's a dance. If you're doing, like, the waltz, you know, the man has to lead or it's not going to work. And that's really what she says. If you don't lead, I can't dance. Dance isn't going to work. In the same way in a relationship, if the man doesn't show his share of leadership, you know, and I say his share, it doesn't mean everything, but his share, then it's going to be problems. There's going to be frustration. And the man's going to say, well, I don't understand why. I'm such a nice guy. I'm doing everything I can to please her, whatever she asks me for, I do. You know, and he doesn't understand. That's really the tragedy.
Do you really kind of blame it on the fact of feminism? You know, women still believe in that.
Well, you know, a lot of people ask me that question. Isn't this the result of feminism that has, you know, pushed women into, you know, to be strong and take leadership, and men have been, are, you know, men have been made out like they're chauvinist pigs, and they're so afraid to step forward. They don't want to be accused of being controlling. And, you know, it is a factor, but nobody says that we have to listen to what, you know, there's lots of ideas people say in the world. It doesn't mean that we have to listen to them all. And really, to me, it's really a reflection that men weren't taught that this is what it means to be man. So because they weren't taught, they're kind of scrambling. They're looking for ideas like, well, how should I be a man? I want to be, you know, if I'm getting married, I want my marriage to be successful. So you're looking for all these ideas, and because these feminist ideas are so, you know, dominant, like you hear them so much, you know, well, this is what I have to be. I don't want to be accused of being controlling, so I'll just let her make all the decisions, and I'm being the nicest guy in the world. And so it's not so much feminism as our lack of knowledge by men to know this is what you're supposed to be as a man, to be strong enough to say, well, you know, this is what I was taught, and this is what I saw work with my parents, and this is how I'm going to be in my marriage. And said we've been so influenced. But, I mean, the same thing with television, the way men are portrayed on television. Like, why, you know, we're so lacking in knowledge of what a man should be. We think, oh, maybe I should be like Homer Simpson and just, you know, assume that I'm incapable of doing anything and my wife has to rescue me all the time. Maybe that's how it's supposed to be. So you know, we can't blame. Take responsibility. What do we have to fix about ourselves? We have to learn how to be strong men who show leadership and take responsibility and not just blame. So, oh, well, it's feminism. I can't do anything about it. Take responsibility. Show leadership. Leadership is I can do something about it. By changing myself, by changing the way I do things, I can improve the situation.
Mm-hmm. I do agree. Callers, listeners, if you have any questions, you could call in at 347-426-3751. Again, 347-426-3751. Elliot and I do not mind answering any questions that you might have. Elliot, now exactly how do the men respond to the ideas in this book? Are they very negative sometimes?
Well, it's interesting because that's, like I said, I thought men, you know, would be supportive of these ideas. Yeah. I mean, and some are. But often, men will disagree with me. Now, like I remember, I was in a wine store. A fellow in front of me in line, he was buying all these different bottles of wine. And he says, I'm getting married, so I'm trying out these different bottles of wine to see which one we want for our wedding. So I said to him, well, congratulations on getting married. But one thing, one piece of, I don't know this, but one piece of advice, remember, you're the man. And he said, oh, no. I let her make all the decisions. It's better that way. And I thought, well, okay, well, good luck. You know, I'm not going to argue with you here in the store. But that's often a response. Like, you know, oh, the woman runs the home. The home is the woman's domain. But and so really, and they, and but see, there's a kicker to that, because then they don't have to solve any problems. They don't have to deal with any of the situations. They don't have to take responsibility. So it's like a kicker. I'm showing I'm this nice guy. And then, but then I don't have to deal with the problems either. And but I think when they come to realize how frustrated, when you point out to them that your wife is really frustrated with this, and they realize that it's true, the women don't like that kind of situation, and eventually it takes time. It's like women, like they see right away, yes, this is what we want. But the men, it takes some talking to them to get through to them, and a lot of them come around and realize. Most of them come around once I talk to them, explain to them, and especially if their marriages are in trouble. They realize, yeah, they have to change. They want to keep their marriages together. They've got to change.
Yeah. So why do so many men not know the traits of being a man that are in your book? Would you say because of not having that father figure?
That's really the main reason. They didn't have someone teach them what it means to be a man. They didn't have a father figure. Like I said, on television, men are portrayed as buffoons. Really, it's like, you know, the media portrays men today. You know, like being a man is something, you know, that has to be cured. Like, there's something wrong with being a man. I mean, some men, like, they're violent, they're abusive. That's terrible. That's not what it means to be a man. You know, when you look up the word manly in the dictionary, as I do, as I explain in the book, I mean, it's a very positive thing. It really struck me, like, It's a man of noble qualities, the admirable qualities of a man of mature character. It's a very positive thing. You know, I tell people on my journey on learning what it means to be a man, I learned what it means to be manly by looking it up in the dictionary. Men we're just not taught. It's and that's really the goal of the book, and I think that's why, you know, it's been, you know, being translated in 24 languages around the world. I was just in contact with the publisher. It's being published in Africa by a publisher there, and he told me he just, you know, sold out the first printing. He just reprinted it again. It's like it's around the world. I mean, it's been published in countries where, you know, like Japan, where you think every man has a geisha, and Brazil, you know, where the whole image of machismo originated. You know, Brazil, it's a really big seller. It's like a universal thing. Like, this generation of men, they just were not taught, and there's a real need for them to learn.
Elliot, apparently it looks like we have a caller on the line. Caller, welcome.
Yes. Hi, how are you doing today?
Doing wonderful.
Good.
Yourself?
Great. I want to say hello to Elliot and the host. I'm Miss Day. I was just listening, and my thoughts to call were based on what you actually both had just talked about in terms of the reasons and rationale as to why men don't know. And I would agree that that's probably the number one reason, because in today's world there's so many divorced homes, so many young men are being raised by women. And so, my question, Elliot, moving forward to you is, and I think you kind of touched on it briefly just now, what would you suggest? How can we change that, where men can learn as young boys coming up how to be a man? Because in most cases, you know, if there's not a man around, you don't have a dad or an uncle or somebody in your immediate circle, that's kind of hard to learn how to be a man for a boy 16, 17, 18, 19. So what do you suggest? How can we just change this?
Well, it's a big challenge. I wrote the book for you know, people, you know, in relationships and, you know, thinking of getting married or are married. But for younger men, I think, you know, you know, it starts, you know, you show leadership from where you stand. You see a situation, you see people that you can teach, then step forward and do it. It's, you know, I had an experience. I was working in an office situation, and one of the support staff, you know, she was listening to a conversation I was having with my daughter, and I was giving my daughter advice, and this woman, she was like the same age as my daughter, she would always like want to walk to the subway with me, and she always wanted to spend time with me, which was okay. And then one day she tells me, you know, her parents are divorced and she hasn't had a father in 10 years. So it's like, you know, I spoke to her and I shared with her, you know, what I would share with my own daughters. So I think that's what we have to do on an individual level, is like when you see someone who could really benefit from, you know, insights about what a man can share with a younger person, do it. And, I mean, there are all kinds of organizations that are trying to do it, but, and then, you know, it starts, each person has to start from where they're standing. They see a person that can benefit, you know, step forward and help that person. You know, you change one person, you're changing the whole world. Don't forget it. You know, you think, oh, I can't change thousands of people, but if you change one person, you're changing the world. So, and that will lead to more people.
Okay. Very, very good. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Okay. Thanks for calling.
Sure thing. Take good job.
Okay,
thank you.
Sure. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you, caller. I appreciate you for calling in. I thank my listeners every day for listening. Really, it's very supportive because I would not be here if it was not for these guys listening. So, Elliot, that was a very good question. I love the fact that we tuned into that because it's very hard for a man to really learn if he doesn't have that father figure. But, Elliot, what makes your approach unique?
Well, I think what makes it unique is that it's really like the timeless wisdom, you know, like it's wisdom that really withstood the test of time. These ideas from, you know, I read that things were written 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago, 500 years ago. Really, and when you read them, and I'm sure you've had this experience, you read them, you say, wow, this is like it was written today. It is so fresh, so relevant, and makes so much sense. And you look at some of the ideas going around today, it's like, you know, it's like, why have we discarded these old ideas without really realizing, you know, how valuable they are? Like, really, like so many people have this idea today, well, you know, if a child has one parent, well, you know, like a mother can be a father and a mother. You know, it's like, you know, a mother is a mother, a father is a father, and really children need, you know, to be influenced by both a male and female role model.
I felt that way growing up. My mother was my mother and father because I lost my father when I was 7, so she became the role figure. When Father's Day came around, happy Father's Day. Mother's Day came around, happy Mother's Day. So that's the type of image I had. So I got a stepfather, but I still depended on her.
Right. Well, I think you know, just so much of the timeless wisdom, like another example I talk about in the book is like, you know, men feel, you know, like the men feel that, you know, their wives aren't supporting them. And really, I hear this all the time. Men will say, you know, oh, you know, I tried to show leadership. She undermined me. She's not supportive to what I'm trying to do. And it's really, you know, it's easy to blame. But one of the ideas that I read that was written like 2,000 years ago is it's really up to the man. It's like you have to work on yourself to be a man that the woman sees as worthy of you know, if she sees you as worthy, she will follow your leadership. So, you know, this question people will say, well, it's not just, you know, I tried to show leadership, you know, she undermined me, so I gave up. It's really about you work on yourself to be a man that your wife can look up to, and then she will admire you. She will follow your leadership. Doesn't mean she'll never disagree with you. Of course she'll disagree with you if she's an intelligent person, and she has things to contribute as well. But, you know, the thing is, don't be oblivious, but step forward, show leadership, but show that you're worthy of being a leader. And it's a matter about working on yourself. Things like, you know, don't blow up in anger. You know, control yourself. That's part of being strong. Like, you know, one source I read also written, you know, thousands of years ago, what does it mean to be strong? To be in control of yourself, to be in control of your passions, of your emotions. It means, you know, don't blow up in anger. You want to be respected? Like, you know, think about it when you see somebody blowing up in anger. You look at them, you think they're a fool. Like, so the same people look at you the same way. If you think, well, I want to be a leader, and they're not following, I'm blowing up in anger. You're showing you're weak. That's a sign of weakness. And all these kinds of insights that I learned, they make so much sense, and they're so fresh and so relevant. it just, you know, that's why I put it together in the book, and you know, just share what I've learned, and you know, I see that it's making a difference in people's lives, and that's what I'm trying to do. It's timeless wisdom that somehow has been lost today, and that's the other thing. You know, people go, like, you hear all these psychologists and people on the radio, newspapers. You know, they give advice. It doesn't even make sense, a lot of this stuff. And you wonder, where do they get these ideas from?
Yeah.
You know, that's what I found. It just, the timeless wisdom really made a lot of sense. And that's why I put it together in the book.
But, Elliot, shouldn't a relationship be balanced? It shouldn't always have to be the man to lead all the time. The woman should be able to do so, too.
No, absolutely, absolutely. You know, it's not about a man making all the decisions. You know, that's what some people say. Is that what you're saying? I said, no, this is about men who make no decision. Of course it should be balanced. You know, there's some things that women know very well, and of course she should make decisions about that. And there's some things a man should make decisions about, and he shouldn't know well, and he should make decisions about. It's really a balance. It's like one of the quotes in the book where it says, you know, if a man, it says, if your wife is short, bend down and seek her advice. But Al says, if you always follow her advice, your life will be hell. So it's telling you two things. If you never listen to your wife, make an effort to listen to her. But if you always just automatically listen to your wife, your life, it's not a life.
Mm-hmm.
I guess another quote I took from a source written 2,000 years ago says, there are three lies that are not lies. A man who has to live off other people, a man whose body is racked in pain, and a man who is ruled by his wife. His life is not a life. It is as if he is not alive. So really, it's a balance. Yes, don't be ruled by your wife, but don't just, you know, automatically do everything. You know, don't control your wife, but at the same time, don't let her control you. It's got to be a balance. Exactly.
Yeah, it does. Well, somebody got it. Both of you can wear the pants. Just keep it at a certain level. But I think we get the contradictory views. You know, we see the strong man, then we see the sensitive guy, but then we see women who might want a sensitive guy, like in the movies, but then at the same time, we hear women who say they want a strong man. So what should we do? The media is playing too much of a part on us.
Well, the media makes it as if it's a choice between the sensitive guy, the nice guy who's really weak, who just really wants to please, and the bad boy, right? That's what they talk about, the nice guy and the bad boy who's strong, he's bad. Like he doesn't show all that, you know, courtesy for you. He's not sensitive to your feelings, but at least he's strong. He takes charge. He makes decisions. So, and they say, well, that's why women are attracted to the bad boy, a lot of women. But really, what are they attracted to? They're attracted to the guy who's actually can make decisions and show some leadership. But really, what they want, I think, is in the middle, a guy who cares about the other person's feelings, but still not just like a limp dish rag who just does whatever he's told. And men think, well, if I just do whatever she wants, she should be happy, and she's not. So it's really in the middle, like someone who takes charge, can make decisions, but, you know, is a decent person, has integrity, strength in his convictions, has moral values, not the bad boy.
Ellen, what sort of man did you actually follow up on when you actually did your book?
Sorry, what kind of man did what?
What man did you follow up on when you did your book? Were there a certain man that you talked to, like divorcees, single guys, bachelors?
I spoke to all kinds of men because really, it was like a journey. I was listening to what men would say. You know, and you know, I saw men who were in good marriages. I saw men who were divorced. You know, that was one of the things that struck me was, I remember when I was, getting divorced, I was invited to this men's group for divorced men, and I thought, well, you know, if I go, I bet these guys are all domineering and controlling, and that's why they're divorced. And I went, and they're all the nicest guys in the world. They couldn't understand. They were like me. They said, well, I'm such a nice guy. Why did our wives not appreciate how nice we were? And so everything I saw really taught me something. I said, well, maybe that was the problem, that we were so nice that we weren't real men. We didn't show leadership. We didn't take charge. Maybe that really was the problem. And so everything was an experience that led me to realize that this is really, be a man. Really, the traditional idea of being a man who takes charge, who shows leadership, you know, who knows what's going on in his family, so he can, you know, try to solve problems. That's what kind of wife a woman. That's the kind of man that makes a wife happy.
Yeah, we want to be happy. We do, and we want you to be that man every day. Is that why you feel that marriages go bad? Because we always have to take control.
I think it's a big factor that people have overlooked. You know, men don't realize just how important that role of being the man who's strong, who shows leadership, who, you know, appreciates his wife. And like a leader, you know, a leader appreciates the people around him, his wife. He shows how, you know, makes them feel how valuable they are, how appreciated they are. All these things so important. And, like, men don't seem to be taught that.
Yeah. Well, is there any other advice that you want to give these men out here today, Elliot, or women?
Well, I think it's, like I say, this comes down to the three main points, because really everything I said comes under those three things. Show leadership. It's not being controlling. It's taking charge and solving the problems that are going on in your family and your relationship. Make decisions. Don't avoid making decisions. Don't be afraid that you're going to make a mistake, because everybody makes mistakes. Really, your wife wants you to show your share of decision making, and take responsibility. Don't blame her. Don't blame anyone. You're the man of the house. Take responsibility. Nobody will have any sympathy for you claiming you're a victim of your wife or anybody else. Take responsibility.
Exactly, and that's all that you're basically saying. But it sounds like, to me, it's easier said than done. I think they're just going to have to keep practicing at this. They're not going to... Well, most guys are just clueless, Elliot. We got to admit that now. They're just clueless. You got to throw stuff at them to make them understand. You throw a book at them, okay, what's this? We got women, if you have to... Take your man time down, turn the pages for him, because obviously he's not going to grab that clue. Might have to write it down for him a little bit, you know. See, Ellen, you understood, you grasped it, but you know every man don't fall in your, you know every man don't fall in the same shoes.
Well, you know, it takes time. You just got to keep working on yourself, catching yourself when you're falling back into your old habits, and just realize, you know, this is really what your wife wants for her to be happy. And just keep doing it, and you will see, you will be her hero.
Yes. So Elliot, before we go off the air, are you involved right now? Because I know you said, did you say you had a fiance in the beginning?
Well, I am involved right now. Yeah, no, it's very nice. It's very nice. It's very pleasant.
I'm glad.
And she appreciates that I take charge. She appreciates that you know, that I'll make the decisions and not leave everything to her. She really does appreciate that. You know, even simple things, like you go to supermarket shopping, you know, should we buy this? Yes. Like, if you're like saying, well, why are you asking me we need to buy? But she's asking, she wants you to make the decision. So I say, yeah, let's buy it. Right? You're laughing, but it's because it's true, right?
Yeah, see, you had to learn the hard way. See, Ellen went through the trials and tribulations. He wrote the book out, so you know exactly what the woman wants. It's for the others to pick up. It's for the others out here to pick up on it, so you know. So, Ellen, do you have any children?
I have two daughters.
Oh. How old are they?
They're 24 and 22.
Oh, okay. So it's no more. Oh, okay. I think they're my old.
They're grown up. They're great kids.
They're all grown. Then they're gonna be looking for that. But see, you are taught. See, by you, unlearned. So they're gonna look for that same type of guy. They're not gonna want any left. you're going to have to treat me the way my father treats his woman. I don't want, don't come. Yeah, and that's a good thing, Ellie. I'm so happy. I am. I'm happy for you. I'm glad you got this new start over.
Thank you.
And that you got your good little weather with your snow. Oh, boy. Ellie, I appreciate you for being on this show and sharing your thoughts and inspiration with us so much. It's good, and I hope everybody goes out, go to Amazon. You can grab the book. I'm sure Barnes & Noble has it. Ellie, if anyone wants to personally get in touch with you, can they?
Sure. They can go to my website, which is beingthestrongman.com.
Yes.
And just say it's on Amazon both as a paperback and as a Kindle ebook, so people can get it, you know, you can get it in a few minutes. And it's also on Kobo.com as an ebook. And in bookstores, it should be in bookstores. If it's sold out, just ask them. They'll order it for you and get it to you pretty quickly.
Okay. Well, thank you, Ellie. I appreciate you.
Okay, thank you.
It
was great to be on your show. You're doing great things to help people.
Thank you. I'm trying. That's what it's all about, motivation.
Yeah.
And I'm here to keep you motivated. So, Ellie, thank you again, and you have a blessed one.
Okay, you too. All the best.
Well, my listeners and my listeners, or shall I say audience, I appreciate you for tuning in. I thank the caller for calling in. Now, we're not done just yet. We still have one more guest to call in, and she is an author, but we will not get to her till about 12 o'clock. So what I am going to do, I'm going to hit you with some tunes, and hopefully you can sit and enjoy doing this commercial-free break, or I might throw in a little commercials. Hey, you never know. This is a show that spontaneous. We like to be live. I like to keep it funny at times, but stay tuned.
It takes 12 years to create a graduate. It takes about the same time to create a dropout. And at the end of the day, the difference between a child becoming one or the other could be you. So United Way is asking you to make a pledge. Tutor a child who needs help. Mentor a kid who needs someone on their side. Volunteer to read to children. Because when a child advances, we all advance. Be a reader, tutor, or mentor. Give. Advocate. Volunteer. Live United. Take the pledge now at liveunited.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
I've been drinking, I get filthy when that liquor get up on me. I've been thinking, why can't I keep my fingers off it, baby? I want you,
DJ.
Feeling like an animal with these cameras all in my grill. Flashing lights, flashing lights. You got me pity, 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 baby. I want you, na-na. Can't keep your eyes off my pity, daddy. I want you, na-na. Drunk in love. I want you. We woke up in the kitchen saying, how the hell did this shit happen? Sing up.
grinding on that wood. I'm swerving on that, swerving, swerving on that. Big body been serving all this, swerve, surfing all in this good, good.
This is Nnamdi Asamoah. I play football for the Philadelphia Eagles, but what I do off the field with United Way might be more important. I'm a volunteer tutor and mentor. Why? Because over a million kids a year drop out of school, and that's not okay. It takes 12 years to create a graduate, but it takes about the same time to create a dropout. And the difference between a child becoming one or the other could be me, or it could be you. Studies show that if we get to these kids earlier, their chances are better, and kids who read well by third grade are more likely to graduate. So join me in United Way. Suit up and take the pledge. Become a volunteer reader, tutor, or mentor. Because when a child succeeds, we all succeed. Give. Advocate. Volunteer. Live United. Take the pledge at unitedway.org. Brought to you by United Way, the Ad Council, and the National Football League.
Yeah. I only look, but I never touch. Drawing me in and you kicking me out. You've got my head spinning, no kidding. I can't pin you down. What's going on in that beautiful mind? I'm on your magical mystery ride. And I'm so dizzy, don't know what hit me. But I'll be alright. My head, but I'm breathing fine. You're crazy and I'm out of my mind. 'Cause all of me loves all of you. Love your curves and all your edges, all your perfect imperfections. Give your all to me, I'll give my all. You're my end and my beginning. Even when I lose, I'm winning. 'Cause I give you all of me, and you give me all of you. Oh, how many times do I have to tell you? Even when you're crying, you're beautiful too. The world is beating you down. I'm around through every mood. You're my downfall, you're my muse. My worst distraction, my rhythm and blues. I can't stop singing, it's ringing in my head for you. My head, I'm breathing fine. You're crazy and I'm out of my mind. 'Cause all of me loves all of you. Love your curves and all your edges, all your perfect imperfections. Give your all to me, I'll give my all. You're my end and my beginning. Even when I lose, I'm winning. 'Cause I give you all of me, and you give me all of you. All your perfect imperfections. Give your all to me, give my all to you. You're my end and my beginning. Even when I lose, I'm winning. 'Cause I give you all. for me, and you give me all of you. I give you all of me, and you give me all of you.
believe God's got a word for somebody in this house tonight. Well, there's an atmosphere of a prophetic voice that's speaking right now. When God shows up, he speaks. He moves. Why don't you lift up your hands right now? Somebody's going to leave encouraged tonight. That heavy burden is lifting right now. That thing you're facing is leaving right now. You're getting your victory right now. Come on, lift up your hands. Somebody who needs to be encouraged. Right now, your faith is returning to you. Your joy is coming back to you. Oh, yeah, 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 yeah.
When Dad needed help getting around, I became his driver. Any daughter would do the same. But soon enough, he needed help doing more things, and it was up to me to be his personal shopper and financial manager, too. And before I knew it, Dad moved in with me, so I became his cook, his personal assistant, his physical therapist, and even his nurse. When I started taking care of Dad, I didn't realize all the roles I'd have to play. But no matter what, I know I'm still his daughter.
We understand the many roles you play. And to help, we created an online caregiving resource center. At aarp.org/caregiving, you can find resources and connect with the caregiving community. Together, we can better care for ourselves and the ones we love. Visit aarp.org/caregiving to learn more. A public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Getting your child home safely.
Tap your heels together 3 times.
Is just a click away.
There is no place like home.
But making sure your child is in the right seat is just one of the steps down the road to safer travel.
I don't know how it works.
Find the right seat for your little one's age and size. There's no better way to get home safely. Know for sure that your child is in the right seat.
How can I ever thank you enough?
Get all the facts at safercar.gov/the right seat. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Just tell me where to go, and I'll take off my clothes.
Just reading an article on Yahoo today about Irina Ronina's racist tweet about President Obama still causing headaches and Sochi. Irina Ronina is one of Russia's most decorated Olympians. Unfortunately, she also seems to be one of the country's most controversial athletes. A racist tweet sent by Ronina in 2013 is causing headaches for the organizers of the 2014 Olympics. A 2013 tweet is back in the spotlight after Ronina lit the Olympic flames at the start of the Winter Games. She deleted the tweet after people called her out for racism, but the athlete never issued an apology. And according to Yahoo Sports, Irina responded to the controversy by saying, "Freedom of speech is freedom of speech." What do you think, callers? Do call in at 347-426-3751. Is freedom of speech freedom of speech, or is it a limit to stop it? The issue was brought back to the forefront this week when she lit the Olympic flame. And some claimed that the Olympian was chosen as the torchbearer for political reasons, but Games Chief Dmitry said that Irina earned her place for her accomplishments in her sport. They also said that she is from the club of three-time gold medalists and one of the most respected in the world. The Olympic Games are not about politics. And so far, the Olympics have not gotten off to a smooth start. Before the Games began, several people tweeted about the associate problems. At the opening ceremony, a glitch caused one of the Olympic rings to get tucked in the snowflake position. And now, thanks to a racist tweet from Irina Ronina, several people believe that Putin is using the Games to make a political statement. So what are your responses to that? Should she have said that, or should she have not? It's freedom of speech. I mean, it's really confusing me because it seems like we're not concerned about it, and then we are concerned. This is a great discussion to open up about. So if you have any opinions on that, please do call in at 347-426-3751. And thank you again for tuning on Blog Talk Radio.
This album is dedicated to everybody that's been close. I hope you've enjoyed this record. I hope it's ministered to your heart and soul. Please continue to keep us in your prayers. And we'll be praying for your family too. I just got one more thing I want to leave with you. If you're going through something, family.
When I cannot feel sparrow sing.
Y'all wouldn't pray if you didn't go through something. And when you go through something, that's where you meet Jesus. Can I get a witness of this? And listen, if you're really sick in your body and feel like giving up, listen.
When the sickness won't leave my body.
Yes, sir.
When the pain just won't leave my soul.
call them.
There's a blessing in the storm.
I need a witness in the
storm. Tell me, there's a blessing in the storm.
Some of y'all have been into some bad relationships, and some of you had your heart broken and you've been lied to. I want to let you know that there is a lover named Jesus, and he will supply your every need. Family.
When I cannot see the love again,
yes, sir.
And the raindrops cold, ever end.
But if you just hold on,
if you just hold on,
these clouds,
those clouds will soon be gone.
Yes, sir.
There's a blessing in the storm.
Come on, somebody.
Help me sing it.
Pressure fell on me. I thought I was gonna lose my mind, but I know. For those of you...
Today might be the day I drop out of school. But you might be able to stop me. With United Way, you could tutor me, be my mentor, or volunteer to just read with me. There are tons of ways people like you can help kids like me stay in school. Make me a success, not a statistic.
Take the pledge to volunteer now at unitedway.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
For those of you that think that gospel music has gone too far, you think we've gotten too radical with our message. Well, I got news for you. You ain't heard nothing yet. And if you don't know, now you know. Glory, glory! Woo! You better put them hands together and act like you know up in here. Chief Pete! Church up in here. Come on.
love you reign above every name.
Yeah. Sing my God reigns.
My God reigns.
Sing our God reigns, y'all.
Our God reigns.
Sing Lord, Lord you reign above every name.
Come on, say with power and majesty.
Power and majesty. Dominion, authority. You reign.
Sing it again with power.
With power and majesty. Dominion, authority. You reign.
Come on, let's go right here.
Oh, sing my God reigns.
Come on.
God reigns.
Sing our God reigns.
Our God.
Tell them, Lord, you reign above every name.
I need to hear you tonight. My God reigns.
By William Murphy. God bless everyone for tuning in today with me on the Bright Side with Technisha. But now I have my other guest on the line, Jade Tisley, who is the author of so many books, especially my favorite one, The 1980s Kid. How are you today, Jade?
I'm doing wonderful. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm glad to have you as a guest on my new show now, because I remember in the past we was at I was at Clay State University, and you were so kind enough to be a guest there for me.
Yeah, I loved being on your show. So when I saw that you had started another show, as soon as I saw that, I thought, oh, I want to be on her show again. So thank you so much for having me on.
You're so welcome. I try to keep everybody motivated, and I said, well, this is the way I can keep you motivated, start my own show now that I'm not in school anymore.
That's the way to go.
So, Jay, you have, this is your fifth anniversary with the book, The 1980s Kid, right?
That's correct.
What actually made you decide to write 1980s Kid?
Well, it was kind of a funny thing. It started in December of 2007, and the iPod had just released, the iTunes store had just released a ton of Bon Jovi videos available on their store. So I downloaded one of them, and it was Bon Jovi's Runaway, which came out in 1984. So I was standing in my living room, and I was watching this video that I hadn't seen in, oh gosh, at that rate, probably 20, 25 years. And it was, I just had the strangest feeling. It was almost kind of like this deja vu, I'm being sucked backwards into a time warp, and I could just remember the first time I ever saw that video in my grandmother's living room on the wooden television set that she had. And it just almost kind of felt like I had straddled two worlds at once. Not only had I fallen back, but at the same time, like I was a little kid looking into this amazing future where you could have a VCR and a color television set right in the palm of your hand. So it was just this really kind of a neat feeling I had, and it stayed with me for a few days after that. So what I had done was I was thinking about that, and then I started thinking about all these other cool things from the 80s, and that was kind of when the idea dawned on me to turn it into a book. I wanted to write about that time.
Now, for the ones who don't know about Jay Hisley, Jay, can you give a little description about your background?
Well, I was born and raised in Pennsylvania. 1980s Kid was my first book. It's a memoir. It's the only true book I've ever written. The others have been fiction. In addition to that, I also teach, so I have a very bookish background. So I guess it's inevitable I would start writing them at some point.
Jay, how do you come up with your ideas for your books?
I really can't explain where the ideas come from. They come from all over the place, and usually what happens is there will be a couple of unrelated things that will happen in short sequence. You know, if I'm looking for ideas, I like to do things like go on long walks outside when the weather's nice, which doesn't happen this time of year in Pennsylvania, pretty much all the Northeast under, you know, snow and ice. But, you know, I love going for walks outside. I love going to antique shops. I like going to bookstores, you know, just hanging out with people. You know, they kind of come from anywhere and everywhere, and it's almost like you have to be on the alert for what's going to strike you at any given point for an idea for a book.
Now, the book first came out 5 years ago, and it continues to grow more popular each year, which rarely happens with books. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think it's because we live in a culture that's still fascinated with the 1980s. So when the book came out and it was popular, people were reading it, and, you know, they were reminiscing about their own memories of the 80s. But then, you know, as time goes on, we've seen the movies are making a comeback, a new generation is discovering the music from that era. If you walk into any toy store in America, half the toys on the shelves were a thing that came out in the 80s. You know, Strawberry Shortcake, My Little Pony, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle. So mm-hmm. clothes are coming back. And I think it's just, you know, as the fascination grows, people are discovering this book more and more. And I think for a lot of people, it's just a great book where they, especially those of us that lived through that era, they can read it and feel like they're living that time period again. And then I've had younger readers who are, you know, in their late teens and mid-20s now, who were born after the 80s came to an end, but, you know, they love that time period. And they'll tell me, you know, oh, my gosh, I read it and I felt like I lived through the 80s. So I think that it's just as our culture continues to, you know, become more fascinated with that whole time period, it's just made the book become more popular. So it's been a win-win.
I see, and I'm happy for you, Jay, that you're coming up. I'm very proud that you're blessed that way. What
Thank
is
you.
This book? You're welcome. What is 1980s Kid about, though?
Well, it's kind of a hybrid of things. It's my true stories of growing up in the 1980s. So a lot of it, you know, I mean, the whole thing takes place during the 80s. So it deals with kind of this whole fascination of the technology that was coming along at that time, because that was really kind of the revolution of personal technology, where you could have, you know, your own entertainment and carry it with you. You know, Sony introduced the Walkman in 1980. Video games were really starting to come into their own into the late 70s, and it was really into the early 80s that, you know, the Atari really started to become popular. So, you know, the VCR came out, and this whole idea of you didn't have to be chained to the television to catch your favorite show. You could, you know, just buy a blind VCR tape and pop it in, and you were actually free to leave the house, you know, if you wanted to do something the night that your favorite show was going to air. So it's kind of like, you know, as a child watching these technologies, because I remember when VCRs were status symbols, at least from the middle class, you know, when computers first came out and how fascinated people were with them. So it kind of, it walks you back through that perspective of a little child discovering all these new technologies, which now seems, you know, fairly laughable now that, you know, two-year-olds can pick up their parents' iPod and watch, you know, whatever they want, whenever they want. But it kind of goes back to that era when all these ideas were new. And then it just talks about, you know, the goofy things that I did as a kid, which people can relate to, I think, regardless of what decade you grew up in. Everybody understands what it's like when you accidentally break one of your sibling's favorite toys and you have to try to cover your tracks, or, you know, you discover that it's not a good idea to shake up a bottle of soda just because you want to see the bubbles build up in the bottle, you know. So it's kind of, you know, this double kind of a layer of, you know, being a child during the 1980s and then kind of like your typical childhood adventures that any kid would have at any point in their growing up years, no matter what era.
Now, going back to the child's period, what were you like at school?
I was actually fairly well behaved at school, I would say, for the most part. I was a pretty good kid. You know, any time that I did anything bratty, it was really kind of like accidental brat kind of a thing, you know, like shaking up the soda. I had no idea that if you shook up a 2-liter of soda, it would explode all over the kitchen and your mom would have to clean up this horrid sugary nightmare of a mess. I just wanted to pick it up because I thought it was really cool because I liked the bubbles and I wanted to see the bubbles go fast. But as far as school goes, for the most part, I was a pretty good kid. But I have to confess, the only bad grade I got in kindergarten was in behavior. I got an N, which stood for needs improvement. And for some strange, sick reason that I can't explain, I am more proud of that than the fact that I made Dean's List in college. So, like you said, for the most part, I was pretty good. But, you know, every once in a while, you're a kid, you got to, you know, act up a little bit.
Yeah, I was the same way. Made the good grades, but had out the blue wanted to act up, and Mama had to put me back in my place. Okay, let's get back right.
Mm-hmm.
Were you good at English?
Yeah, I was for the most part. Once I got into high school and we really started to, you know, look at literature and creative writing and things like that. But all through junior high, this whole mess of, you know, conjugating verbs and diagramming sentences, I was never into that. So I didn't like the technical aspects of the English language, but any time that we were, you know, reading anything, I was always really into that. I love American literature, particularly 20th century American literature. So I was very much into that, and any time that we were given a creative writing assignment, I, you know, really threw myself into it. I always found that really enjoyable. So, you know, dealing with the literature aspects of English, I loved it. Talking about the technical, you know, let's dissect sentences, not so much.
Now, speaking on bratty scrapes, now, in the book, you got into some bratty scrapes, including problems
mm-hmm.
with the squirt gun and a 2-liter of soda. Tell us about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the squirt gun thing started out very innocently back
mm-hmm.
in the early 80s, well before the Super Soaker came out, because the Super Soaker didn't come out until 1989, thank goodness, otherwise you probably got in a lot worse trouble. But back when squirt guns were fairly simple and you could buy them for less than a dollar, my aunt gave me my first squirt gun, and I was about 5 years old, and I thought it was the coolest thing in the world. I had never had one before. So my mom filled it up with water for me, and I was running around the backyard, and yeah, I was just having a good old time just, you know, squirting water at, you know, imaginary targets and whatnot. And next door to the house that I grew up in, there was another house, and this lady who, you know, she was always nice to me, she had a beauty parlor you know, just built into our home. So as I am running around out in the backyard, this gentleman steps out of this little beauty shop with a fresh haircut. So I was standing, what seemed to be really far away, you know, I was five, so, and I was really short. And I thought I was standing pretty far away from him, so I thought, oh, I'll pretend to squirt him. So I pointed my squirt gun at him, and I started pulling the trigger, and he just starts screaming and spazzing and flipping out, and I'm thinking, what in the world's the problem here? So I ignored the fact that he was throwing a spasm, so I just kept on squirting and kept on squirting, and then to my horror, I realized that his light blue shirt had a great big dark blue spot on it. So I knew I was going to be in trouble, so I booked into the house as fast as I could. I ditched the squirt gun on the porch, and it was a Saturday, and my parents were sitting at the table talking, and they said, you know, oh, how are you doing? And I was like, good, you know, because I thought I cannot go in there and tell him I just hosed down this guy. I'm going to get in trouble. So they said, you know, oh, you know, you having fun? Yeah. So I just sat there like this perfect little angel, and they're just going on about whatever, you know, boring grown-up stuff they're talking about. And I thought I was home free until the neighbor lady decided to come over and tell my mom and dad that I had, you know, drenched one of her clients. So, you know, my mom has this tone. When we were growing up, I always called it the loud question tone, which is when she knew the truth and she was trying to pry it out of you anyway, kind of a thing. Yeah. So she says, did you squirt somebody that was coming out of the beauty shop? And I said, no, not really, because in my little head I wasn't lying, because I didn't try to get the guy wet. So, you know, in my little five-year-old opinion, I was completely innocent of this crime I was now charged with. So she said, is the neighbor lady lying to me and Daddy? And I was like, oh, yes, that is the best thing ever. I love that whole thought. And, you know, I thought that would be like the most brilliant way to get out of the situation. But I could tell with a loud question tone, she knew what the real deal was. So, you know, I said, well, maybe she's not exactly lying. So my dad was like, okay, if you didn't squirt him and she's not lying, something isn't right. What's the real deal? So I said, well, this guy, he comes out of the beauty shop, and I pretended to squirt him, and I was standing really, 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 really super far away, and I didn't think he was going to get wet, so I didn't really squirt him on purpose. And so my mom said that I had to go next door and apologize, which I couldn't believe that, you know, I was faced with such an injustice. Why would I have to go and apologize for something that I didn't intend to do? So all I can say is that thankfully at that point, the guy who I have just always simply referred to as the scary man was gone by that point, which is good because, you know, I was five and I was terrified of him after that screaming fit because I thought, you know, he is going, I thought he was like a bad guy out of a fairy tale. I thought he's going to take me home and he's going to make me work as a slave and then he's going to cook me for lunch and he probably lived in a gingerbread house. I mean, every evil fairy tale villain thing that children were told, because this was back before all the Disney movies were available on VCR tape, so, you know, most of my generation hadn't seen them at that point, so anything came out of a European fairy tale, I thought, this guy embodies. So, you know, my mom made me go next door and apologize to the neighbor lady, because thankfully that guy was gone. And, you know, she seemed to have a bad attitude about it, and I couldn't figure out why. She was always nice to me, and, you know, I just saw myself as this poor little innocent victim of circumstance, so... You know, but when you're five, what are you going to do? And then my dad took my squirt gun, and I wasn't allowed to have it for several weeks. And, you know, it was awful because he dumped all the water out of it and he stuck it on top of the refrigerator. And when you're 5 years old, you know, if somebody's going to put something on top of the refrigerator, they might as well stick it on top of a skyscraper because you're just not going to get a hold of it. So, you know, that was kind of a traumatizing experience. Looking back, I can't blame my parents, but at the age of five, I mean, what a hard injustice. It's bad.
So how much of 1980s kid is true?
Honestly, every word of that book is true. You know, I really did come from a huge family and a small town. You know, I really did get into every scrape that's mentioned in the book. They're not exaggerated at all. I really did that. And the exploding soda incident, you know, was true. The, I mean, all of it was true. And I think every 1980s kid can relate to, you know, when you leave the car in the summer, you do it very slowly because, you know, the vinyl seats of the car were going to rip all the skin off the back of your legs if you stood up too quickly and that sort of thing. So honestly, every word of that book was true.
Now, I'm a 1980s baby. I was born in 1983, and I see that this has gotten a lot of attention in the past few years. But why do you think people are still interested in that time?
Well, I think, you know, the 1980s were a very different time in a lot of ways to the ones that we're growing up in now. Now, I think there's a similarity as far as there's new technology coming out constantly. So I think that's something that people can relate to. But, you know, the 70s were a rough time for America and for a lot of people. You know, the Vietnam War was very controversial.
Yeah.
And it still was, you know, a lot of people still have very mixed opinions on that. So, you know, the 70s, you know, were there. We had this controversial war we were dealing with. You had the Watergate scandal, so people didn't trust the government. And I think, you know, Vietnam was also a part of that. You know, OPEC had formed, so oil prices were going out of control. You know, we had all these kind of, you know, economic problems were in our country. So all these things were going on, and then the 80s came along, and the economy stabilized. We started to be able to put Vietnam behind us and all these different things. So I think it was kind of like this time where it wasn't just about the popular culture. It was about the political climate at the time. It was the fact that, you know, I think as a nation we were finally starting to feel on top again. You know, people were finding jobs again. You know, people were developing more economic security than they had. Prosperity had come back to the country again. So I think that if you look at our time period now, you know, we're dealing with some of those themes, you know, that we had to deal with in the 70s. You know, people aren't really sure whether or not they trust the government right now. You know, some people are, you know, kind of uncertain about that. You know, we're in a war that people have differing opinions on. Certainly we're having a lot of economic troubles. So I think that people, when they look back to the 80s, they're kind of almost looking for that sense of security again that they had back then. So I think that that is why that time period, in at least in part, is so appealing now, because, you know, it was very nice to grow up in a time where everybody had money. So, you know, which isn't always the case nowadays. So I think that's a part of the reason why people are fascinated with that time. It isn't just because of the pop culture, which was completely awesome, but I think also it was just kind of the climate of the country, if you will, at that time, is why people tend to look back on it with a lot of nostalgia.
So, Jay, with the American childhood has changed from the 1980s until now, but how do you think it really has changed so much? We already know that mostly the technology, as we were saying, two-year-olds know how to use an iPad now. They're so advanced. Are there any other changes that you see differently?
Well, I think one of the things, and I love the technology that exists nowadays, don't get me wrong, I would be a liar if I said anything against it, because I have a smartphone and, you know, and a Kindle and an iPod and all that sort of thing. But I think one of the things that's kind of getting lost is that, you know, nowadays with everybody having this technology, it almost seems like kids don't play with toys anymore. They just play with apps, a lot of them. And it seems like if you go somewhere and there's a lot of kids there, they're not always necessarily interacting with each other. They're just content to kind of sit and play with their mom or dad's smartphone or their own tablet or whatever. So I think that's one thing that's unfortunately kind of getting lost in our cultures. It seems like people are so obsessed with their own technology that it's starting to make relationships suffer. And, you know, I think sometimes parents really should tell the kid, no, you're not going to play with my phone. You can, you know, go hang out with the other kids right now. But even not just with kids, I mean, I think you see that nowadays. If you go to, you know, any type of a social gathering, you know, 20, 30 years ago, people would go and they'd talk to each other. Nowadays, if you go on, you know, at least half the time, half the people are, you know, updating their phones and you know, checking their Facebook statuses from their phones and whatnot. So, you know, I think, unfortunately, that is one of the things that we've lost as a culture, but especially as kids. You know, this technology is, whether or not we realize it, it's distracting from having real relationships and real interactions with people.
It is, because now children don't even like to pick up a dictionary. They don't even know what a dictionary is. We have, to me, the generation has become lazy. It has, and I guess I'm probably, mine's going to be behind because I don't even have an iPad for them. I don't even let them play on my phone. Mommy, can I use your phone? No. I'm not going to start it. We're going to use the dictionary over here. We're going to look for these words the old-fashioned way. We're going to go to the library like we used to. You actually had to go to the library. There was no computers hardly mm-hmm. where you could just look through or anything. So, yeah, my kids are stone age, Jay. They're very stone age.
I think that's great. You know, I think that's going to give them a tremendous advantage when they go to college if they know to actually pick up a book. Because, you know, it's the whole information literacy question now. You know, so many young people, it doesn't even occur to them that 78% at least of what's on the Internet just isn't true. You know, they don't get necessarily the idea that anybody can put up a website and make it look legit, you know, and put on whatever wacky conspiracy theories that they want. And, you know, as opposed to books, you know, there's a lot more control, quality control with publishers and making sure that the information is accurate. And people might argue and say, well, you know, books can become outdated. Well, yeah, but if you pick up a current book, which is easier than ever to do, you know, now that we have Amazon and things like that, you know, it's, you know, like I said, I think it's kind of a shame, but I think your kids are going to be at a tremendous advantage if, you know, if you make them stay off the technology and learn how to really navigate through books and libraries. I think that's a great advantage that you're giving them.
Exactly, because I was watching on Good Morning America, Fisher-Price was creating a, I think it's a bouncer, and the babies, and they have the little iPad on it, and I'm like, why would you? A baby at 6 or 7 months, what are they going to do with that? They don't.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, they trying to create. Yeah, Jay, they trying to create that. And some parents were against it, which I don't blame them. Come on, if you don't have time for your own children, then that's a problem. But to get them occupied, as one of the doctors were saying, if you don't have time, if you got to take a bath or something, take them in the bathroom with you. Let them play with some blocks or something, but not out. I just think this generation is in trouble. They are. They're seriously in trouble because you talk to some of them now, what is that? It's technology mm-hmm. just moving. It's becoming scary. And now you see FedEx. They're going to be doing these little androids, dropping off your mail. I don't know what to say. I think we're just in trouble. And the only way we can help our youth, we're going to have to grab them real quick and get them back on the right track.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I think their attention spans are getting shorter and shorter and shorter because they're used to being able to just push a button and everything just magically appears in front of them. So, you know, how's this going to work when they have to work for 8 hours a day and can't have their phone? You know?
Exactly. I mean, they're used to it.
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to be used to it. They're not going to be knowing the value of hard work because even these classes
exactly.
are doing a pass now.
Mhm. Yeah, I agree.
But Jay, let's get on some favorite little things. What are some of your favorite shows from the 1980s?
Oh gosh, I still like Full House. I have to admit it. I still like Full House. There was a great show on PBS when I was little called Square One Television, and it dealt entirely with math, and they had a segment at the end of every episode called MathNet, which was a parody of Dragnet, and it had these mathematician detectives, Kate Munday and George Frankly, and I own all the DVDs that are available of that series. You know, it's my childhood hero was Kate Munday, who was played by a brilliant actress by the name of Beverly Leach, who's still working. You know, it's that... That, to me, was a lot of fun. I think the kids need to have more heroes on TV now, but I was also a huge fan of The Muppet Babies, Garfield and Friends, Pee-wee's Playhouse. I mean, Saturday mornings were like, you know, Christmas Day, almost in terms of how great the television shows were.
And Jay, you're so right. I used to love Saturday morning. You get a quick just to watch cartoons. I used to watch Recess, The Muppet Babies, too.
Uh-huh.
I used to love Family Matters, and when they had Nickelodeon, I used to love watching Nickelodeon.
Me too.
Eureka's Castle, I used to get up for that. Let me see, what else?
The Elephant Show was another Nickelodeon classic.
Yep. I think sometimes you could catch them, too. I think they got the Nick for 90s or something on DirecTV now. You could catch some of them old shows. And sometimes if I can't, I like to order them off Amazon or eBay, too. Because it just brings back those memories. These are the shows I grew up on. Now they got SpongeBob. No offense, I don't understand SpongeBob. I really don't, but the kids obviously love them. Now, my kids, they're not really a fan of anything. If they see it, they see it. But other than that, they're not wrong. Mommy, I need SpongeBob. I need Dora the Explorer. They're not focused on one character, so I'm glad they're not wrecking my nerves with that. And I see that you used to love, the show that's not airing anymore, Gilmore Girls.
Yes, yes, that was a great show. I mean, it was just so original. I love the writing. You know, how they could just go back and forth from anything. Like, you know, one minute they're talking about, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, and the next minute they're talking about Shakespeare, and then they're talking about Martin Luther, and then they're talking about Bananarama. So I just think it was Amy Sherman Palladino created that show, and I think she's a great writer, and just a wonderfully funny show. You know, I mean, that truly, I think, took the dramedy to a whole new level.
Do you have any favorite movies or songs from the 1980s?
Well, I think that was a great decade for kids' movies. They came up with some wonderful adventure movies. Flight of the Navigator was a great one. Short Circuit, The Boy Who Could Fly, E.T., so, you know, we really had some great ones. And then I've also come to appreciate some of the really good dramas that came out in the 80s that my mom would not let me see, you know, until I was an adult. But the Dead Poets Society, The Breakfast Club, Kind of Wonderful, which was a great John Hughes movie. It was the last teen movie he ever wrote. Certainly there were some great movies from that time period that I think still really resonate. So, even though a lot of the slang in Breakfast Club can be kind of indecipherable at times, it's still, you know, it's just a great movie.
Oh, yeah, Breakfast Club is always going to be a known movie for most of us from the 80s. Were there any favorite songs that you enjoyed from the 80s?
I'm sorry?
Were there any favorite songs that you enjoyed from the 80s?
I still have to say Walking on Sunshine by Katrina and the Waves will always probably be one of my favorites from that decade. Hey Mickey by Tony Basil was another great one.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of people don't know that she was in her 40s when she made that video.
Oh,
so,
wow.
Yeah, go Tony. that was a great one. That was one of the, classic video. Of course, Michael Jackson did some amazing videos at that point. I mean, you know, did some incredible dancing. But I remember when I was in kindergarten, that was like kind of the dividing line in my kindergarten class was, if you're brave enough to watch all 14 minutes of Thriller the whole way through, you're a big kid. And if you were too scared to watch the whole way through, then you were a baby. And so even though, like, it, you know, now as an adult I can appreciate it and think, wow, you know, what a great video. When I was a kid, I have to admit, you know, that was pretty scary, but I forced myself to watch it so I could go to kindergarten and say I was a big kid. So even though, like I said, it was a little scary when you're five, but it was a rite of passage and it was a matter of pride, so I did have to watch it. And now, fortunately, I can say I've come to a place of mental and emotional maturity where I can watch it and it doesn't scare me, and I can just appreciate it for the great video that it is.
Yeah, I'll tell you, Michael was a bad boy. There was nobody who could really put it down like Michael. He had everybody, and I said, you're definitely bad if you got everybody in every country who knows about you. That's when you know you got it. I cried so bad, Jade, when he passed away, I couldn't help it. I just cried. I watched every single video possibly that was out on him. My husband had to lure me away from the TV. He was like, come on now, we got to stop this. I said, I can't help. Because he felt like he was a part of you. And today, you know, I still hear negative comments and stuff, and I'm like, well, I don't want to entwine into that. But, you know, you still here. But to me, he's always going to be a great songwriter, artist, no matter what. He was just Michael. And there's no other body like him. But I need for his kids to get together. I need for them to get together. Stop doing all this little extra stuff to get yourself in the news. Paris, you don't need to do whatever you're doing to get into the news. You know that you're an icon because your daddy was an icon. So we need her to keep it together.
All these children never need to keep it together. I don't understand what's going on with them, Jade. I mean, time you turn on the news, they're doing something for Justin Bieber driving crazy. You're doing drugs. Come on.
I don't get it. You know, I mean, people have these wonderful opportunities, and then it seems like they just, you know, squander so much through just, you know, reckless choices. So, you know, hopefully, he's still young. Hopefully he can get his act together.
I hope so, too. And Lizzie Lohan, I hope she's still on the right track. I mean, you look at them, they're so cute, like her in The Parent Trap. You admired her being in there. You followed her in that movie. But and then you look at her, and now, I mean, come on. Really? And all I have to ask is, where is the parent intervention at? Like, because if that part, my mom, hey, what are you thinking? She probably been on slapping across my head. You seriously doing that? You embarrass yourself like that?
Well, I was going to say, as far as the whole, you know, question of where's the parents, there's a great article that Mara Wilson wrote probably 6 or 7 months ago at this rate. And it was called 7 Reasons Why Child Stars Go Nuts. And that was really insightful for somebody who had been on, you know, who had been a very popular child star. So, you know, and she thinks that one of the reasons why, you know, child stars have these problems is because if a kid who's not famous, if they do something bad, they get in trouble and they're held accountable. And they said, well, child stars, that's not the case. You've got a group of 12 very highly paid people, you know, paying off whoever they have to pay off to keep it out of the news, and it's basically you have people running around cleaning up your messes and you're not held accountable. And the only lesson they walk away with is, I can get away with this. So, you know, it's a great article, and I think it was pretty insightful. So, but, yeah, it kind of makes you wonder.
Yeah, he got me wondering right now, because that is a thing. Hey, there's nothing that you're going to do to me. You know, I could get off. Well, sometimes in the way you look at it in the media, it does appear to be that way. Okay, they did something wrong, but they're getting off. But if I go do it, I'm gonna do time. So, how did the 1980s change life as we know it, Jade?
I think the biggest thing is probably the technology that came out at that point. You know, the personal computer revolution, as it's called, I think is probably the biggest. You know, I think that you know, this whole idea, and I remember at the time, which it sounds really funny now, but my parents got a computer in 1985, literally came over to the house to see it because they had never seen a computer before. Because at that point, you know, they had all been like, you know, the IBM mainframes and, you know, the huge setup. So this whole idea that, wow, you could have a computer in your house, you know, and this whole idea of, well, what are you going to do with it kind of a thing. So I think the computer technology that came along during that decade has probably been what has shaped our modern world more than anything else. So, you know, I think it's kind of funny because if you think, you know, back then you had your separate stereo system and you had the computer system and you had a VCR and you had a television and, you know, now you can walk around with it in the palm of your hand. So it's really amazing the way the technology has changed, but I think computers have been the biggest change from the 80s to walk us into where we are now in the world because, you know, Apple was one of the biggest brands in the world. And, you know, I think a lot of the money that comes into this country from other countries are going for our technology. So, you know, definitely, I think the Apple computer really revolutionized the world. And I don't think it's an overstatement to say that.
No, it's not because you don't even need all you really probably need a computer for is just to type. And now technology has advanced so much you don't even really need that. And Verizon, I think that's Verizon who created the watch on your arm. All you got to do is press it and you can answer your call now.
I've seen those.
Yeah, they're stealing all these ideas from the shows. What was the show? Was it Knight Rider with Michael in it where he had the talking cars? See, everything's coming from what we grew up on. I used to love that show, too. I loved
that
one. Mm-hmm. So all the stuff that we're used to watching, they took. I figured they was going to end up doing it. They taking all these ideas from the old shows, and now they're creating it, trying to create robots now. They even create a robot. I was thinking, because I love Good Morning America, the couples
spent, I think, $1,500 on a robot for their wedding. You know, instead of just getting a regular ring barrier, they ordered a robot. They said it was a lot easier, so now this is what we're going to go to. And after a while, we're going to have robots in our kitchen cooking. Now, you're not going to be cooking my food. I'm not going to be burned out of house in the home, but that's exactly what this is getting to, Jay. We're going to have robots driving cars. This is proof that people actually sit down and they're actually doing this. I mean, and the problem, the thing that's worrying me the most is, will we have a job in a couple of more years or in the near future later on? I mean, because these robots, they're creating all this stuff. These robots are going to be taking over our jobs after a while. They're going to be serving tables, washing dishes. I'm kind of seeing a little bit of this technology. They're doing too much for me.
Yeah, as I say, it's amazing. You know, it'll be scary to think, you know, what will be accomplished in the next 10 or 20 years when you consider how far we've come in the last 10 or 20. So I guess we'll have to see.
Oh, exactly. If you could change one thing about life today and so that it was more like the 1980s, what would that be?
I don't think I would diminish the technology, but I think I would, and this kind of goes back to something I said a little bit earlier, I think it would kind of diminish people's almost their constant need to be on it. You know, like I said, you know, with the whole constantly feeling the need to be on their cell phones at all time, you know, and not even just talking, but just, you know, with the constant apps and everything else, you know, I think that would be nice to see that, you know, to leave the technology there, but to have people be less emotionally dependent on it, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that would be the one thing I would change.
Because most people would not survive if they did not have their cell phone. That's what I like about when I go to work, we're not allowed to have our cell phone, so that sort of helps me a little because I know I can't touch it. I can't touch
mm-hmm.
the cell phone, so that's 8 hours that I'm without it. And obviously, it doesn't bother me. It doesn't, because
right.
I don't have to be on Facebook every 5 minutes. Oh, let me see what this person said, or Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
I got to tweet this, or Instagram. It's becoming addictive. It's
mm-hmm.
so sad. And like we were talking previously, people be so caught up, don't nobody like to communicate anymore. That's why I love Toastmasters, which is an organization for public speaker and leadership, which
mm-hmm.
I'm part of. I'm part of Cascade United Toastmasters, and that's what we do. We communicate, we give speeches, and that sort of helps bring back in reality. Yeah.
Right.
So those type of organizations are wonderful. You're right, Jay, we have lost total communication. Shoot.
Mm-hmm.
After a while, nobody ain't going to want to kiss in a relationship. They created an app, and you could just send your kisses through the app now. That's how it's going to be. You just send your kisses through the app. You don't have to look at me face to face. And I'm laughing about this, but this is how far technology is going to go out. So why are they going to create apps? Well, you don't even have to worry about hugging your mate anymore. I'm telling you, Jay, they just going bizarre with all these apps and technology.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's things are changing fast, that's for sure.
Now, what are some of the things about the 1980s that you don't want to see come back?
Well, the one thing I would have to say can stay in the 80s is the mullet. I mean, talk about, like, one of the most horrible hairdos ever invented. You know, I mean, I'm all for, like, the big hair coming back. I mean, I'm okay with that as long as it's not a mullet. You know, it's just what a hard hairdo. I don't know what anybody was thinking. You know, I mean, I guess some would say it was a natural, continuation of the shag haircut from the 70s. And, you know, that wasn't the most attractive look either. But, yeah, I mean, you know, I'm okay with most of the clothes coming back, although I really don't have any plans to ever peg my pants again, no matter how popular that might become. But, yeah, as long as, like, the mullets and the rat tails can stay in the 80s, you know, with most of the rest of it, I'm okay with.
Yeah, I remember them rat tails, long piece of hair just hanging down.
Yeah, it's just so gross. And I think that, you know, that was, like, when people were getting ready to, you know, break their emotional ties with a mullet, but they couldn't do it completely. You know, a lot of people just had their mullets fit into rat tails, and it's like, not a good look.
Just, I'm just going to wear this, cut my hair up into a box, and have this long piece of hair hanging down. Boy, amazing how times have changed.
Yes, it is.
Do you interact with your fans online?
Yes, I do. I have Facebook, and I have a Twitter account, and, you know, I've got email and all that sort of thing. So, yeah, I do, and I do love hearing from my readers. A lot of them send me emails or send me messages over Facebook. So I do actually respond to everybody that doesn't come across just like a creepy stalker weirdo. But I do get back with everybody. It can take me up to a week or more sometimes, just depending on the volume. But, you know, I love it when, you know, people send me emails and they tell me that, you know, my books made them laugh or made them think or, you know, or changed them in some way, which is always a very humbling thing when people tell me that sort of thing. So, yeah, you know, if people reach out, I reach back. So as long as they're not creepy scary.
Now speaking of the laughter, incorrigible, if I'm saying it correct, incorrigible dreamers, that was
yes.
not really on the funny style, and How to Rule the World was a mix of your humorous style and serious themes. What made you want to step out from doing humor and these type books?
Well, with The Incorrigible Dreamers, there was almost no humor in that at all. I mean, there was one guy that was a little bit of a smart aleck, so there was a touch of it here and there. But I kind of wanted to step away from humor for that type of story. I just didn't think it would work. But that book came out in 2010. And it was just kind of an outgrowth of a lot of the conversations, you know, I had been having with people at that point, because a lot of people were very discouraged. A lot of people, you know, were coming out of college, you know, with a ton of debt, and they couldn't find work. And so it was kind of this whole kind of a depressing bubble, if you will, that just kind of came out in society of this idea of, you know, we did everything right and it just didn't work out and the rules changed partway through the game and we came out on the losing end of it. So, you know, I wrote this book, The Incorrigible Dreamers, and it was about, you know, people who go after these amazing goals and then for some reason, you know, it's like they get there and then it just doesn't work out and then you're left with a choice. Do you try to, you know, resurrect what you wanted to do or do you just give up and walk away? So for the tone of that book, which that's still one of my more popular titles, but for the tone of that book, I didn't think the humor was appropriate. But then as far as How to Rule the World goes, you know, I did certainly incorporate some humor in that. But again, that kind of just dealt with that that kind of disillusionment when you hit early adulthood where, you know, maybe you think, you know, everything about society is great and wonderful and right will always prevail, and sometimes it doesn't. So, you know, I think most people go through that period in early adulthood where they're somewhat disillusioned about life. So, you know, but then again, you're just kind of left with this option of, okay, you know, now what are you going to do? Who are you going to choose to be and how are you going to choose how to live your life? So, you know, that book, I had to kind of straddle the two between the humor and kind of the whole kind of a book.
So while you're writing, are there any writers that really inspire you, Jade?
Boy, I have to say, I think one of my all-time favorite novels is To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee. I just think it's an incredible, incredible book because it makes people think. It's changed people's perspectives. And no matter whomever I bring this book in, you know, up to, I have never heard anybody say that they didn't like that book, which is, I mean, that almost never happens with a book. And I just really admire the fact that she was able to tackle a subject and, you know, do it in such an amazing way and, you know, show this the story through the eyes of innocent children. And, I mean, she's just a great writer. I mean, what a masterwork. And it was voted by the American Library Association as the greatest novel of the 20th century, and I think that's an honor that was very much deserved. So, you know, I really like the way that Harper Lee could, she's just a master storyteller. You know, that's you know, really what all I can think to say. So I think that's great. You know, she's a great novel writer, but I also like Jean Shepherd a lot, who wrote this wonderful book called In God We Trust, All Others Pay Cash. And parts of that book were adapted into the movie A Christmas Story. about Ralphie Parker just wanting his BB gun. So I love the way that he could write about childhood and do it, you know, in a really, really funny and amazing way. You know, he's got an incredible vocabulary. So I think his writing style is just tremendously unique. So he's another favorite of mine.
Now, can you give us a little insight into maybe one of your main characters out of your book and why he or she is just so special to you?
I think one of my favorite characters that I've ever created was Elise Bayonne, who was in the book The Incorrigible Dreamers. She was a silent film star who successfully transitioned into talking pictures and ended up being cut from her studio contract. You know, she was kind of, you know, going back to this whole Incorrigible Dreamers theme, she was somebody who had, you know, come to a place where she had to make a decision about what she was going to do with her life. And so I really like that character because, you know, of course she was very successful and, you know, is a very attractive actress, but there was a lot more depth to her character than what most people would probably guess is on the surface. You know, I think she's a very mature character in that sense. I think she's just a wonderful example of how, you know, people can choose to cultivate their lives any way that they would choose. So I think out of all my characters, she's one of my absolute favorites for that reason.
So are you working on anything at the moment, on another book?
I'm actually working on a couple, it's tricky, and it's just kind of the way I write. Maybe it's a sloppy method, but, you know, I am working on a few different things, and it just kind of, you know, some days I wake up and I want to decide, you know, I'm going to work on this book, and I'll work on that, and I'll focus on that for a few weeks, and then I'll get an idea for one of my other ones I've worked on, so I'll focus on that for a couple of days, and then I'll bounce, you know, back and forth. So, you know, my books are, you know, people are like, oh, what's the next book going to be about? I think, I don't know, whichever one I finish first. So, which, as I said, is probably a sloppy method, but that's how I work.
So would it be more towards funny or drama?
What I'm working on now tends more towards, I think more overall is drama, but there's definitely some humor in it because one of the ones I'm working on right now involves a boy who's a tad bit of a brat at times, which that's always fun for me to write because, you know, when I was starting out writing comedies a few years ago, fiction comedies anyways, I had to stop and ask myself, okay, who are the funniest people in society? And for me, that answer was bratty little kids and mouthy old ladies. So, I love writing about bratty little kids. You know, I think that's, for me, it's just kind of it's a wonderful outlet when you're expected to be an adult and act like an adult. It's just fun when you can kind of escape into these worlds where you can be a bratty little kid and whatever little schemes and scrapes you want. It's just fun. It's fun escapism when you don't always necessarily want to be a grown-up all the time.
So, yeah.
There's my immature confession.
it appears that you like more of your books to be on the comical side. Is that mostly what most of your books are about? And if so, what draws you to that genre?
Yeah, definitely. That is a fair statement to say that most of my books are humor and rely very heavily on humor. I don't know. I think it's just funny. It's just fun to write those kind of things. And I think that's probably my writing goes in that direction because that's where my head goes in that direction. You know, when I'm sitting around talking to somebody, not that I'm not capable of grown-up conversation, because I am, but, you know, I usually just like to point out the absurd and the funny things that happen in life because, you know, I as much as it's a cliche, laughter really is the best medicine. And, you know, I just enjoy, you know, joking around, so that's my personality. So I guess it makes sense that that's where my writing would focus on more than anything.
Now, Jay, did they ever come out with a movie for one of your books, or have they came out with a movie? Not yet.
No, there are no movies that are solely about my books. But there is an independent film called Death Suspects and Murder that was written and produced by Matthew S. Robinson, and he was actually kind enough to want to include my books in the film. So that for me was a big thrill to get to see that, because one of the characters in the movie, Joanna Jordan, who's played by an actress named Jessica White, her character is very big, into reading. And there's a couple different scenes in the movie where she's reading, and she's reading my book. So that was a big thrill. So that was kind of like my little taste of Hollywood. But right now there's nothing in the works. But if I was going to see any one of my books turn into a movie, I think either 1980s Kid or The Incorrigible Dreamers would be my pick. I think 1980s Kid would just be a lot of fun. I think it would resonate with a lot of people. But The Incorrigible Dreamers, I think, would be another one that would be a good movie to have on film.
Now, which actor or actress would you like to see playing the lead character from your most recent book?
Oh, from the most recent one, How to Rule the World. Let's see here. The main character, and that was Wendy Sloan, so I'd need somebody who'd be about 19 years old. I think Jennifer Lawrence would be able to handle that role pretty well. You know, if she can convincingly do Katniss, I think she could handle Wendy Sloan. So looking for, considering anybody that age, yeah, I would say Jennifer Lawrence, I think, could do that role pretty well.
Now, Jay, most of your books come from the heart. It's about most of your life experiences, but are there any parts in it where you have to do research? And if so, how much do you have to do?
That just kind of depends on the time period. I think the one that I had to do the most research for was Brady Becky and the Firecracker Kid, because when that book starts out, it starts out in the year 1906. So I really try to write the history of the books flawlessly. So I know with that one, I had to do a lot of research on etymology and word history, because there were certain words that I wanted to put down in that book that I couldn't, because I try to remember what some of the words were that I wanted to use. But I would look them up, and some of them, they would say, the earliest known usage was 1925. So I had to choose a lot of the words in that book very carefully. So I didn't want there to be anything out of place. But for me, that's one of my biggest pet peeves, is when I sit down to watch a movie or a TV show and it takes place in a historic time period and they're using expressions that are 40 or 50 years, ahead of what would have been used at that time, or, the wardrobe and the costumes are completely off by 10 or 20 years. So I know for me, for Brady Becky and the Firecracker Kid, I had to research all kinds of things to try to keep it as focused as I could on that time period. I think I did a pretty good job, because nobody sent me any emails yet saying I really messed something up historically. So, knock on wood, hopefully that doesn't happen. But to say whenever I write something historical, I really try to go all out as best as I can to not have anything be out of place. So I put a lot of emphasis on that.
Have you written any other novels in collaboration with other writers?
No, I've never written anything as a collaboration with somebody else. I know people ask me quite frequently. I get literally hundreds of requests a year for me to write books for other people, which I always turn down because, number one, there's just not enough hours in the day. But, number two, people will come up to me and they'll be like, they don't even ask, they'll just command me. They'll say, like, I have an idea for a book, and I'm going to tell you what it is, and you'll write it, and we'll split the money. which I think is kind of nervy and rude that they don't even say, oh, by the way, please. Anytime somebody says that to me, what I want to say, and I always try to be polite about it, but what I really want to say right back to them is, I have an idea for a full-time job for you, and I'll tell you what it is, and then you go out and work the job, and we'll split the money.
So,
I get literally hundreds of requests a year for from people wanting me to write books, and I think a lot of times they just don't understand, how much goes into it, and it really is a multi-year project, and it really is, it's a huge commitment, and, and I know for me, I've got tons of different things that I'm working on, so, if I live to be 200 years old, I probably will not be able to finish all the books that I've had ideas for. So, I've never collaborated with any other writers just for that reason alone, because I just
I've got so much going on with my own career, I really can't, you know, stop and slow down and take on a multi-year project with anybody else. So that's why. Don't hate me, listening audience.
Well, Jay, I like how you said that. Jay said he just come up to me and say, hey, yo, got an idea, we're going to write it, we're going to split the money. Sure, but I did like how you said yours too. Yeah, you go out, you work full-time job, and then you bring me back the proceedings and all the sales and everything. Come on.
I know, I think some people, or they'll tell me, two or three sentences, and it's like, you seriously think you're going to give me two or three sentences, and I'm going to have to write that into a book, and we'll split them? I'm thinking, I got enough ideas of my own, I'm sorry, I mean, if people want to write a book, that's great, go out and write a book, but... Yeah, like I said, it's interesting.
Yeah. And it's don't understand, it's work behind that. Sure, the book is published, but it takes time to concentrate and put your ideas into that book. Have you ever was there ever a time you had writer's block, Jay?
Fortunately, I don't have to deal with it very often. I know with Bratty Becky and the Firecracker Kid, I didn't have, quote-unquote, writer's block, but I had two different endings in mind, and I wasn't sure which one to pick, so that took me probably 6 weeks of writing it one way and then the other way and trying to figure out which one I wanted to use. And then so what I did was I was actually kind of able to knit them together. So it did have, I don't want to say it had a double ending because that wouldn't make sense, but I was able to kind of use both ideas to bring it together to close the novel. So, I don't know if that's writer's block so much as that's writer's overload, but that was one time when I really kind of hit a point where I was working on a book and I thought, okay, I'm not sure how this is going to work, but I made it work. It took me a few weeks, but I made it work.
Okay. Now, do you write every day, 5 days a week, or as and when?
Mostly I do write every day. Every once in a while I get myself a day off, but it's really a labor of love. So, I really enjoy, writing every day. Typically, I enjoy writing most in the evenings because, once the day is over and I don't have to stop and think about anything else that needs to be done or that I have to go somewhere or do something. So I really enjoy writing in the evenings and at night because I just feel like, time doesn't exist, if you will. In that kind of a context, and I'm just kind of free to write whatever I want to and not have to worry about other things and other commitments.
Now, when do you work to an outline or plot, or do you just prefer just see where an idea takes you?
I just go where the ideas take me. To be honest, I have never sat and plotted anything out. Now, if I was going to, maybe write some, complicated crime novel or something someday, I probably would, but typically I just kind of like to see where it goes because, as books go on and characters become more developed, I just kind of like to see where the story's going to go. I know some writers, they start with a plot and they know exactly where they're going to end, and I don't necessarily do that. I just kind of like to see how the characters grow and change and see what they decide to do.
Mm-hmm. I like that. So, Jay, just to get a couple of more questions on there before I chime in. What's the easiest thing about writing for you?
Oh, gosh. I think once you get rolling with it, maybe for me it's about 20 or 30 pages into it and you really know the characters and they almost kind of just take over the story themselves. So that's always kind of a fun place to get to that point where, the characters, kind of have taken over and they're their own personalities, if you will. So for me, that's always kind of the most fun.
Oh. And Jade, is there anything else you would like to add that I haven't included?
I think you covered all of it. I would just say that, if anybody wants to check out my work, they can go to my website. It's www.jadeheasley.com. Or people can just, Google 1980s kid. That'd be another way that they could find me. So, I just want to throw that out there. If anybody is interested, if you go to my website, that's where you'll find links to go to Amazon and get the books. You can find out about the movie that my books were in or find me on Facebook or Twitter or get a hold of me through email. So all the information is on my webpage.
Jay, I really thank you very much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to take part in this interview. And you know,
hey,
it's always a
so
pleasure
much.
To have you. Thank you so much, Jay, and you have a blessed one.
All right. Thank you so much. You have a great day.
You too.
You're so annoying.
You're so annoying.
Stop copying me.
Stop copying me.
Mom, tell her to stop copying me.
Mom, tell her to stop talking me.
Kids will spend 10 minutes copying everything their sibling says.
You're such a doofus.
You're such a doofus.
How about 2 minutes to brush their teeth? Brushing for 2 minutes now can save your child from severe tooth pain later. For fun 2-minute videos to watch while brushing, visit 2min2x.org. 2 minutes, twice a day. I have the time.
Mom!
A message from the Partnership for Healthy Mouths, Healthy Lives, and the Ad Council.
Thank you for tuning in to The Bright Side with Tanisha.
Come back daily from 12 p.m. to 1 p.m. Eastern.
God bless.